Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
When everyone's on the same page, getting things done at work is easy. No matter what you do or what industry you're in, how you communicate is key. Everything you type is equally important to collaboration, and Grammarly can help. Think of it as your AI writing partner, empowering you to communicate effectively and efficiently, so you can make a bigger impact in the workplace. 96% of Grammarly users say it helps them craft more impactful writing. And as the gold standard of responsible AI, Grammarly is your secure AI writing partner that allows your team to make their point and move faster. By understanding your writing in context, Grammarly provides relevant, personalized suggestions. And with tone suggestions, you can navigate even the most difficult work conversations. You can also save time from spending hours editing drafts to just seconds with one click. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Easier said, done.
Hi there, and welcome to the Explaining History podcast. And today I want to look at a period of time in British imperial history from 1945 to 1948 with two withdrawals and two partitions, namely that of India and Palestine. And to address really the idea that Britain had an orderly withdrawal from empire and a peaceful one, and the evidence obviously suggests that this is not a tenable position anyone can realistically take anymore. In neither the case of Palestine or India can it be said that a settlement is created and that the partition of both countries is not a solution particularly that could be seen as a particularly successful one. In fact, the problem of emergent nationalism and tribalism and the development of nation states, particularly in India with India and Pakistan, but the growth of the birth of the modern nation state of Israel meant that there would be forces unleashed that were beyond the remit, beyond the ability of British imperial administrators or the desire of British imperial administrators to control. In both cases, the decolonising administrations saw partition, particularly in the case of Mountbatten and India, as the lesser of two evils. The degree of indecision of rushed timing and of chaos surrounding the two partitions is interesting. From 1937 onwards, the British had given thought, following the Arab revolt, of partitioning Palestine. And the job actually is done not by the British but by the United Nations. The Labour government simply hands the problem over to the United Nations, and partition is the part of the UN partition plan. In India, in the same time period in 1947, as we've already seen in a previous podcast, Sir Cyril Radcliffe headed the Boundary Commission in early 1947. The date of withdrawal is brought forward dramatically due to Britain's financial troubles post-war and following the end of currency controls on sterling as a part of the stipulation for the loan that Keynes was offered in 1945. Again, there's a podcast on the Keynes loan if you want to listen to it. And this meant that Britain, by 1947, is bankrupt. So the job of decolonisation has to speed up apace. In Palestine, the chances of creating a settlement between Jews and Arabs and the chances of creating compromise are undermined mainly by the events of the Second World War. The fact of the Holocaust and the development of new and more aggressive militant Zionism from Europe, and the fact that persecution of Jewish people continued after 1945, that countries in Eastern Europe expelled their Jews, Stalinism essentially finished off the war against the Jews that Hitler had begun in expelling Jews from Europe, and the civil strife within Poland, Ukraine and other countries claimed large numbers of Jewish survivors, and so a huge increase in flight from Europe happened after 1945. The British had also made a problem for themselves in destroying the Arab political leadership during the Arab uprising from 1936 to 1939. Large numbers of them had been jailed, exiled or executed. There had been arguments between different elements of the Arab leadership over the failure of the uprising. The Husseinis, the Grand Mufti of Palestine, Haj Amin al-Husseini, returned to Palestine, given his brief flirtation with Hitler during the war, and in 1946 was head of the Arab Higher Committee, which was the kind of the working authority during the uprising. The Chamberlain government in 1939 had a plan to divide Palestine. And this was mainly designed to benefit British interests in the Middle East, as all these things invariably were. And the question about what to do about Palestine and the Chamberlain partition plan re-emerged in 1945, and obviously the world situation is extremely different. Here at the United Nations, you found an American input which is far more favourable to Zionists than the British had been in 1939. And this is a factor of this entire period, is that prior to the war, this was a great power question. After the end of the Second World War, this is a superpower and a Cold War question. The idea of the United States becoming involved in the workings of the British Empire in 1939 is quite unrealistic. The United States is chiefly involved in the workings of both the British and French empires and the fate of their colonies and former colonies after 1945. But the British have a problem. If the Americans choose to support the Zionist cause and the British give way, as they have to because they want things like martial aid and all sorts of concessions and help from America, and really America during Britain's austerity years is an indispensable ally in actually keeping the empire going, much to the dislike and distrust of both Republican and Democratic congressmen alike. But in taking, in favouring the Zionist cause, as the British feel they have to, they enrage Arab opinion, not just in Palestine, but across the other parts of Britain's Middle Eastern empire, such as Egypt. The British were keen to hang on to bases along the Suez Canal zone. They had good relations with King Abdullah of Transjordan, who in his own right was interested in acquiring land from Palestine if the territory was to be carved up. And Transjordan itself was likely to become a useful and reliable British client state in the Middle East. The British population has little interest in Palestine and basically never has done. When Zionist bombs went off in London shortly after the war, there was even more even more desire to rid oneself of the entire problem, and Palestine is extremely expensive. The solution that's proposed by the Foreign Office was to create a bi-nation state, so and something, some Austro-Hungarian type affair, where both sides would be would have kind of relative autonomy, and there would be a 2-to-1 ratio between Arabs and Jews in across the country. The fact that this is fair, you know, as fair a settlement as possible, was neither here nor there. It's unrealistic. It was rejected. A single Jewish state would also rub up the wrong way. Precisely the very Arab partners that the British are hoping to keep on side to further their own imperial interests in the Middle East. Some Arab leaders embraced the idea of a partition. The Zionists reject it, America therefore rejects it, and actually the Soviets reject it as well. That Palestine had originally been a League of Nations mandate, and the United Nations, the direct heir of the League of Nations, meant that the British could hand over the mandate, you know, hand it back. But again, this carries risks with it too. Not only in the United Nations General Assembly, where there are increasing numbers of newly decolonised nations that resented imperial powers like Britain and saw no reason to help them, but also the Americans have a huge power in the United Nations, and an American solution is almost certainly not going to be favourable towards British interests. So the calculation really is, can we steer the partition and independence of Palestine so that it will prop up British interests post-war? Or is it going to be too difficult? And if it's too difficult and we hand it over to the United Nations, are we then relinquishing power to influence the situation at all? And will countries who are either A, ambivalent towards Great Britain, or B, actually quite hostile towards Great Britain, decide what happens in the Middle East and therefore what control Britain will be able to exert over the rest of the region? The British government itself was divided. Hugh Dalton, Nye Bevin and Emmanuel Shinwell, Zionists in the cabinet, were outflanked and outclassed really by the Foreign Office. So Ernest Bevin and the army as well laid out to the Zionists in the cabinet really the bigger strategic picture that of Britain in the Middle East. And it is these guys that win the day. Even though Bevin didn't have the confidence of Clement Attlee, who was largely unconvinced that Britain was going to have a continued role in the Middle East. The fact that British policy is caving in and the Anglo-American Committee of Inquiry, which featured the backbencher Richard Crossman, which sat over the period, the winter of 45 to 46, and came with the conclusion that Britain could no longer go on in Palestine. The fact that there were hostile forces arraigned against Britain as Britain sought a solution that would benefit itself meant that the choice to hand Palestine over to the United Nations became irresistible by 1947. The British government reject the first partition plan in September 1947. This was the proposal with the binational state. As this is rejected and the timetable for withdrawal speeds up for 1948, a withdrawal without a political settlement is on the cards, and this can mean only one thing, civil war. One can see here really a breathtaking irresponsibility. The British thought that the problem now handed over to the United Nations would be resolved, that the United Nations would somehow find a solution, and that the dividing of Palestine into an Arab and an Israeli state would be able to avert an Arab-Israeli war. In the run-up to the outbreak of hostilities, there are attempts between Arabs and Jews to show some kind of solidarity, a general strike that crosses ethnic lines, for example. The problems that the Arabs had was that their movement since the Arab Revolt, as previously mentioned, was immensely divided. There were internecine feuds and a great deal of anger about who was responsible for the defeat. And this fed neatly into the plans of King Abdullah to carve out part of the West Bank. On the 22nd of July 1946, the decision by Menachem Begin's Irgun to blow up the Jerusalem's King David Hotel, which was the central point of the central administrative building for the Mandate Secretariat, mainly killing local Jewish administrative workers, was a morale blow to the British that they never really come back from. British attitudes towards the Jews of the Palestine Mandate after the bombing of the King David Hotel range from deep resentment amongst many of the officers who see themselves as having been attacked when they arguably helped Jewish people during the war. In their view, the campaigns of the British Army were never motivated by a fear for or a concern for the Jews, but the net effect, the many British officers believed at the end of the war they'd done good things to help Jews and liberated Belsen and that kind of thing. And then there were British servicemen who were shocked at the condition of Jews arriving in Palestine and deeply sympathetic towards them, particularly when they are shipped off to internment camps in other places. Because of the ban on emigration of Jews into the Mandate. Overall, towards the end of the Mandate, there is a feeling amongst British personnel, amongst the Palestine Police Service and the British Army, that the entire mission in Palestine is a waste of time. And there's a sense of, you know, bewilderment as to what Britain is actually doing in Palestine. This is intensified in 1947 when the Stern Gang, a separate terrorist organisation from Begin's Irgun, began to bomb London with the help of the French, who had a long-standing enmity with the British over the Palestinian Mandate, and who, if you, the book to read on this, by the way, is James Barr's brilliant book, A Line in the Sand, and the disputes between the British and the French, which make both look particularly bad, over Palestine, Lebanon, Syria, and Iraq, date back from 1919. Really through to 1946-47. An ex-servicemen's club and a bomb that was planted deep in the heart of the Colonial Office, which mercifully fails to go off due to a failed detonator, but would have been an atrocity on the King David Hotel proportions. These were added to by the probably most shocking attack on the British during the period was the kidnapping of two British Army sergeants, Cliff Martin and Mervyn Pace, who were hanged by the Irgun. This was a tit-for-tat killing in retaliation for the shooting of three Irgun men who had broken out of jail. And it was these sorts of events that awoke a latent and not too carefully hidden anti-Semitism in Britain, which had always really been there. The Oswald Mosley returned after internment during the war to active politics, bringing his own brand of British fascism briefly back to the streets of London in the 40s and then later on in the 1950s. And the overall feeling within Britain is a kind of a latent anger and resentment towards the Palestinian problem. And it seems to be something that Britain can't quite find the means to divest itself of. There is an immense frustration that Britain has to seem to be kind of enduring these problems as the weeks and months wear on. The main issue, of course, is finance. Britain just cannot afford it anymore. And what Britain certainly can't afford to do is to commit more troops to the policing of a mandate that it's questionable whether Britain has any interest in any longer. And the question of what to do about India at this time also kind of returns and places a great pressure on the British and their dealings with Palestine, making it more likely that Britain will want to hand the problem over to the United Nations. Because obviously a solution to Palestine that is solely on Britain's terms involves probably a commitment of more troops to manage the transition to some kind of independence or some kind of partition. Far better to let the United Nations do it. And far, if, of course, there are immense pressures on India at the same time. So the process of decolonisation in both countries is interrelated and has a bearing on one another. And also, neither decolonisation is particularly simple. Now, in this podcast, I've talked about the Indian partition at length in about half a dozen previous podcasts, and they're all there, so you can search for those. So I don't want to kind of go over old ground. I'm chiefly interested in looking at the relationship between Britain, the rest of its empire, the United States, and the world situation, and the problems of withdrawing from the Palestinian mandate. The French were making the problem of Palestine even worse by allowing a free flow of Jewish migrants, those who, as previously mentioned, were desperate to flee Europe as persecution continued, down to the port of Marseille, where ships were there are ready to take them on the journey across the Mediterranean to Palestine. In 1947, MI6 began to attach mines to freighters to sink them in a fit of desperation. And in 1948, Georges Bidon signed an arms deal with Haganah, the proto-Israeli Defence Force, which meant that they would be firstly well armed, and the inference was that these arms would not necessarily, would no doubt be used against the Arabs, but if they were turned against the British, this would not be any bad thing either. The Irgun and the Lehi, whilst targeting all British personnel as legitimate targets, also had their work cut out in targeting the Arabs. And both sides particularly were keen on attacking villages and settlements. So whilst the British faced a terrorist insurgency, a civil war was also brewing between the two sides, of which one, the losing side, and in this case it was the Arabs, would face an ethnic cleansing. The British public really only see the Britain's side of this and see simply the British under attack by ungrateful Jews. The British were, of course, outraged at French collusion in helping the Jews to reach the mandate, and also French collusion in terrorist operations against Britain. But it would be Britain's treatment of Jews who had made it to the mandate that would lose it world sympathy. The ship, the Exodus, in 1947, that set sail from France to the Mandate, was boarded on the 18th of July by Royal Navy ships off the coast of Gaza, and the crew and the refugees were taken off and taken to Haifa, where they were put on British warships and then sailed back to France. The British, in perhaps the most blundering and inappropriate and crass and insensitive manner that they could possibly have conceived of, from there shipped the presently Jewish refugees to the British occupied zone of Germany, and having nowhere else to put them back in death camps that had yet to be razed to the ground. And when the Jews in these camps rioted, the British set fire hoses on them. When the Civil War broke out and 600,000 Palestinians left their homes, they fled or were forcibly expelled, massacres motivating this considerably, the level of ethnic cleansing is far greater than anything that was that was possible in places such as the Punjab in India. The villages that Arabs had inhabited for centuries were razed to the ground, and the cultural memory of Arabs in those places was also removed physically by the loss of the villages, and also by the loss of the people who had lived there. But the scale of the catastrophe, it doesn't really linger on particularly in British British memory. Certainly the partition does, and films such as Gandhi, for example, raise all sorts of uncomfortable questions. The mandate, the partition of the mandate, and the withdrawal of Britain, and the Nakba, the mass exodus of the Arabs, that really is a minority discourse. And certainly it's something that the Attlee and future British administrations were happy to duck any responsibility for. Okay, well, I've gone on far too long. So I just wanted to ask you guys, if you can, we'd be hugely grateful if you can give us a rating on iTunes. It's pretty much how these podcasts grow. Obviously, make it a good one. A 5-star rating would be lovely. Thank you so much. And also, if you're really interested in reading more about this, get Martin Thomas's book Fight or Flight from all good bookshops, and make sure that you
where you can support your independent bookshop. That and James Barr's A Line in the Sand are indispensable books on this topic area. Thanks very much, and I'll catch you on the next Explaining History podcast. Bye-bye.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Want your most burning finance and investing questions answered? Here's a podcast you should be listening to, courtesy of Acast Recommends.
Are you ready for some personality in your personal finances? Hi, I'm Janice Torres Rodriguez, Latina money expert and host of the award-winning podcast, Yo Quiero Dinero. On this show, we're serving up POC-friendly personal finance knowledge, always with a side of sass. We're not talking about avocado toast and lattes on this show. We've got real, relatable personal finance knowledge that makes you feel seen, heard, and finally understood. Consider me your super cool, slightly risque, but always honest financial fairy godmother. Together, we'll tackle dinero in a fresh new way so you can finally become poderosa with your dinero. Check out our weekly podcast episodes at YoQuieroDineroPodcast.com or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.